This cannot be happening. I remember when I received the phone call, I was actually at my boys' soccer practice, and I had just got the news that the dream that I had was ending. And I'm in shock, going, this can't be real. Really? There's gotta be another way. I'm trying to bargain. But no, the dream that I had was killed. And I don't think it's helpful for me to share with you what dream and conversation I'm talking about right now, because I believe you have had the same phone call at your soccer game or basketball court or outside of the apartment or wherever it may be, where you've received some life-altering news and you think, this cannot be real. This has to be fake. But no, this is the new reality. Today's passage is one of those times. One scholar calls this text the most horrendous tale in the Bible. There's this image up here, this painting of the text. And yeah, I would say one of the most horrendous tales in all of the Bible. Like, looking at this, it just feels barbaric. It seems like God is commanding Abraham to commit murder, to sacrifice, to kill his one and only son. Now, can God do that? I thought God was good. It doesn't seem right that God would say, kill your son. Like, and so our knee-jerk reaction is, this is barbaric. I know that God is love. This cannot be true. But what do we do with this? What, like, this text has baffled theologians for thousands of years, because this text should disturb us. A father is asked to sacrifice his son. The covenant promise is gone. Nothing about this text is comfortable. And it pushes us to ask really hard questions. What do we do when we don't understand what God's doing? How do you respond when you don't understand and you don't have a picture of the whole picture? And I think that's the point of this text. This text is forcing you and I to ask the question, what do I do when God doesn't make sense? You ever felt that before? Like, God, this doesn't make sense. This does not add up. And it's asking you the uncomfortable question, what do I do, and can God be trusted even now? And that is why I titled the sermon this morning, The Most Disturbing Story in the Bible. Welcome to The Most Disturbing Story in the Bible. We're going to talk about it this way, in three ways. When God seems impossible, when God asks the impossible, and when God does the impossible. So first, when God seems impossible. Verse 1 says, sometime later. This chapter begins with sometime later. It almost feels like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, right? It's very vague, just sometime later. So some context, if you've not been with us, Abraham had been given this promise decades before that he and his wife Sarah would have a child. Decades go by, they do not have a child. They are now 100 years old and 90 years old, and they're starting to get cynical about that. And then God says, no, you still will have a child. Sarah laughs, the cynical laugh, but then Isaac comes. We heard about that a few weeks ago. And they lived happily ever after, right? The promised child came. That's the way we want our stories to end, with they lived happily ever after. But then verse 1 comes, sometime later. Now, it doesn't give us clarity on how much time, but we can deduce that it was, let's say, 15 years. Isaac would have had to have been around a teenager because he's being asked to carry the wood on his back up the mountain. And to be able to carry that amount of wood for a burnt offering, you needed to be able to be strong enough to do that. So let's say he's a teenager. Give you an idea of who is being asked to be sacrificed. And then verse 2, God says, "Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering." And you just go, what? Isaac is the promised one. It doesn't make sense. God said, I'm going to give you this child. And for years and decades, they waited, and finally the child arrives. And now, 15 years later, God says, sacrifice him. Like, you have to go like, no, you're wrong, God. And it's wrong for you to ask this. Like, can God really be a moral monster? There's times it feels like it. And so this passage is disturbing for Christians to wrestle with. And so let's play a game. Maybe that'll help us lighten the mood a little bit. Let's play a game. I'll ask the questions, you answer them. So I'll ask, you just give us a yes or no. First question, here we go. Did God tell Abraham to kill his son? Yes. We heard one no, many yeses. We'll go with the yeses. The yeses have it. All right, second question. Does God change?
No.
No. Okay, that was a little more uniformity on that. So we had yes, then we had no. Third question. Since you have already said that God does not change, and since you have already mostly said that God has given license to sacrifice children, my third question is it possible that God might require you to kill a child? It's super uncomfortable. Let me get you one more question to make it real uncomfortable. If God told you to kill a child, would you? Parents are going to stop. It is wild to actually consider this passage, for us to really wrestle with these things. And one scholar says this passage is going to force you to give up one of three things. One of three things I want us to question here. It's either we question the morality of God, either we question the immutability of God, or three, we question our understanding of the text. And so let's go with the first one. Maybe we need to question our understanding, question the morality of God. Maybe this actually isn't immoral for God to do this. But that doesn't seem to fly, because the Ten Commandments, right? You shall not murder, right? Deuteronomy and Leviticus make very explicitly that God says, I do not want child sacrifice. You can think of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, who's consistently saying, let's have an ethic of nonviolence, in that when your enemy strikes, you turn the other cheek and love your enemy. So this doesn't seem to work. That seems to be odd, that God would say to kill when everywhere else he's saying to not kill, right? Now, someone might say, well, it's okay if God told you to do it. It was okay because God told Abraham. It wouldn't be okay if Abraham did it on his own, but if God told him. And I just want to say, all manner of evil has been used to justify that line of thinking. So much genocide has happened when someone says, God told me, this is a holy mission. No. I reject that. So I don't think it's one. Two, you might say, let's question the immutability of God. Like, that was God then, but that's not God now. That was the Old Testament God, but the New Testament God's a little more lovey-dovey. And I think many Christians like to live in this side of the equation. But if that is true, then I feel like most of our religion, most of our understanding of God just falls apart. I think the immutability of God is a non-negotiable. I mean, Hebrews 13 says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So if Jesus is God, which I think we all agree that Jesus is God, he does not change. God does not change. The immutability of God is essential to our understanding of God. Because if God does change, if you say, no, God, he grew. He grew in understanding. He grew in this way. And you go, no. Because if God changes his mind here, what's to stop him from changing his mind later? If God was saying, this was bad now, but it's okay later, like we have no, there's no reason for us to hold any convictions as Christians to say, no, this is wrong or this is right. Because who knows what God might do later? No, like we have to believe Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. I think it's important for us. So then I would say that leaves us number three. We question our understanding of the text. I think this is a really healthy thing for us to do, whether we're talking about this passage or in all of life. Ask the question, maybe, did I miss something? I think this is just helpful in every setting, and just assume, like, maybe I'm missing something. It pushes you to be curious. When you have humility to say, I may not have all the facts, because this doesn't seem right, but maybe I don't have all the facts. I think whether you're in a conversation about what you're doing this weekend or whatever your conversations are, if you begin with, maybe I'm wrong, it just, it helps so much. But let's use number three here. Maybe we don't have a full picture of what's happening in this text. And so let me give you a little bit of context here. In Abraham's day, the ancient gods of the time, not real gods, we don't believe, but the understanding that other gods, it is very, very common for them to accept child sacrifice. It was common for gods to ask for child sacrifice. And we kind of cringe at that. We're like, that seems very barbaric. But that's the culture then. The culture today, though, the culture we live in, we see God as more of the God who leans into love and grace. And yay, amen. We'll get there. But I fear, with our distinct cultures here that we live in now, we may have traded something that was very valuable then. That the culture then, though accepted child sacrifice, believed very deep in their hearts in the holiness of God. That there is a holy God, that when we come in his presence, we should come fearfully, reverently, and in awe. And in today, it feels like the way we approach God is more like a buddy. Like, what's up, bro? And I want to lean into the love and compassion of God. But there is a holiness of God that I don't want to lose behind. Like, that is important. And so remembering that context, because they believed that God was holy, they believed that meant we owe everything to God. Acts 17, Paul says that the way we understand God, for in him we live and move and have our being. This is our understanding that everything we have belongs to the Lord. For in him we live and move and have our being. And so, the very air I breathe, the reason I get to breathe it is because God is allowing that to happen. That all of the reason that my atoms are holding together is because God is allowing those things to happen. The reason that they would make sacrifices in other religions and in Christianity or in Judaism was because God commanded them to have sacrifices. And they knew that if that God controls whether it rains or not, that meant whether they had water or not. That meant whether they had food or not. So they had a reverence for God. And so they came and God said, here's what I'm going to ask. I'm going to ask not for everything, even though you owe everything to me. I'm going to ask for the first. And this is why there's the practice of offering the first to God, the first offering, the first grain offering, the first cow. And this is why it's not completely out of pocket. For when God says, now offer me your first son. Now, let me be very, very clear. I do not believe that God is actually asking Abraham to murder his son. So I'm with whoever said no on that first tenet there. I do not believe God is actually asking him, because if he did, he could have said, kill him right now. But in the text, it doesn't say, murder your son. It says, offer him, which is different. He says, offer your son in this time. That is a very important spot to make clear. And yet, I realize that isn't super satisfactory. It still feels like God is putting us in a very impossible position. It still feels wrong. And again, I think that's the point. I think that's the point. It's for us to ask, what do we do when God seems impossible? Some of us may have recently got a diagnosis. Like, what are you doing, God? Maybe something has changed. You got earth-shattering news. Maybe something's happening with your work. You're like, what is happening, God? What do we do when we don't trust God? Are we willing to take the next step? So, God is still going to call his people to something more here. And I want you to see that in those moments, faith often begins when understanding ends. That faith begins where your understanding ends. It's not a lot for you to say, trust in God, and you're not being questioned. Like, what does that mean to trust in God? Your faith usually begins where you're understanding, where you're not sure how it's going to work out. You actually have to trust in God. So, we talked about when God seems impossible, but let's look at when God asks the impossible. Verse 2, God says, take your son, your only son, whom you love. Oh, man. Take the thing that you love. He doesn't say, take your sheep. He doesn't say, take your money. He doesn't say, take your comforts. He says, take the thing that you love the most. Why? And I think the skeleton key to this whole passage is actually in very, very beginning in verse 1, where God says, and God tested Abraham. That it is a test of God. Notice it doesn't say God tempted Abraham. A temptation is designed to make you fail, right? A test is designed to reveal what's already there. So if you're trying to test the strength of the bridge, people are testing it to see if it's strong, to see what's already there, the strength of it. God is testing Abraham to reveal something to him that he doesn't even know himself, because Abraham honestly has failed this test so many times before. Abraham has got an F on that test so many times before. Say, do you trust God? Sure, I trust God. And then he continues to lie about whether his wife is his wife or not, and gives her away to these other royal dignitaries. Do you trust God? Sure, I trust God. And then the promise to have a child, well, it doesn't seem like it's happening, so I'll go after my wife's servant. He continues to not trust God. And yet now, God says, do you trust me? And what happens today? Today, something wild happens. In verse 3, early the next morning, God says, go sacrifice your son. He says, sure, the next morning. Would you wait a little bit longer than that? I think I would, boys, I would. But the question does put us in an uncomfortable position. Will God test us like he tested Abraham? Will God test you like he tests Abraham? And I want to say yes and no. We'll start with the no first. No, in the sense that God usually doesn't test in the same exact way, but also we heard throughout history, Abraham didn't have a full, complete picture of the redemptive drama. He didn't have the Ten Commandments. He didn't have Deuteronomy and Leviticus. to tell him very clearly that God doesn't want murder, doesn't want child sacrifice. So Abraham didn't have the full picture. And so now we know God will not go against his own word in this way. So God is, if you feel like God is calling you to murder your own children, heads up, feel like it's a bold statement, a word from the Lord is coming to you right now, you're wrong. If you feel like God is asking you to murder anyone, no, that is not from the Lord. Test those spirits. I don't think they're from the Lord. So no, he will not test you in the way he tested Abraham, but yes, God will test you. God will ask you to sacrifice one thing. And if you came to the Lord and you said, Lord, I'll follow you, I'll give up everything for you, but I don't want to give up this. What is that for you? I've had many times over the years when people who are interested in the faith ask me, hey, if I do follow Christ, do I have to stop doing this, this, and this? And they're like, maybe I'll wait until 10 years from now. Let me just do these things until I'm ready. If you ask those questions yourself, like, do I really have to give up this to follow God? Can I give you a working definition of God? Here's my working definition of God. You might have a definition on your own of, you know, we can say God is spirit, right? My working definition here is your non-negotiable. God is your non-negotiable. So if I said, hey, to follow Christ, here's what you need to do. You need to give up this way of making money. If this way of making money is sinful, to follow Christ, you need to give up this unhealthy relationship. And you say, I can't. That is now, if we're bargaining, that's your non-negotiable. I'm not doing it. And whatever that non-negotiable is, that is your functional God. If you say, I can't give this up, this is the most important thing to me, that is your God. Whether it's you're saying like, oh, this is my child, this is my career, this is my dream, I cannot give up this dream. And if it feels like God is asking that of you and you say, no, definitely not, I would say that is your functional God. And many times God puts his finger on the thing that you fear of losing the most. Not because God hates you and wants to make you angry with him, because he wants to reveal to you those functional gods are not big enough to worship like that. If you've made your child your God, that is too much weight to put on a child. If you've made that dream or that job your God, it will not fulfill you. It will fall down and you will come crushing down. You'll come crashing down because of it. And God is trying to free you from that. If you ever go to the beach, you see, if you ever go to the beach and you just go out there and you just sit in the sand and you hold up the sand in your hands, just holding the sand in your hands like a bowl. That sand will stay in your hand as long as you make it into a bowl. But if you then said, you know, I love this sand. This sand is my life. And you start clenching it tightly, and many times those non-negotiables, we clench very tightly. What happens when you hold the sand and you clench it tightly? It starts falling through your fingers. It starts falling out. I want everyone here for 30 seconds, clench your fists. Clench them as hard as you can till it hurts. Clench hard. These dreams, this career, this relationship, this person, I have to have this. And many times when you're clenching like this, it starts to hurt, yes? When you clench so hard, it actually hurts you, the thing that you're holding on to so tightly. Now let go. Feels good, right? Now open up your hands, open palm. When you hold it like that, you allow yourself to, yes, hold the thing rightly so that the sand stays in there, but you also allow for the Lord to take it out of your hands. And you allow for the Lord to put something new there, to receive something good there. It forces us to have an open posture, saying, all of this is the Lord's anyways. I offer it to him. I possess this thing, but I will not be possessed by this thing. God may ask you to offer that up, but offering it to free you. So, when God seems impossible, when God asks the impossible, but now let's talk about when God does the impossible. God does the impossible here. This is an epic story. We talk about the most disturbing story in the Bible, but it is a gripping, riveting story, right? Abraham receives this call and says, go sacrifice your son on this mountain. And this mountain is 80 miles away, so he has to walk 3 days to go to this mountain. And you think every step had to have just been agony. Every step saying, can God really be trusted? Can God really provide? And he has his son with him. His son is carrying the firewood. Ugh. And then he binds the boy when they get to the mountain, ties the boy down. Think of the fear that's happening right now. And then the knife is raised. It's said in Hebrews that Abraham actually believed he would kill his son here, but God would resurrect him. But as he's about to lay the knife down, God steps in verse 12, do not lay a hand on the boy. This is the climax of the story. Like, the tension is right there. Like, knife is raised, promise lost, and God says, stop. In for the save. And it's just a frightening story. But I'd say even more frightening than a child sacrifice here is the tension that has not been resolved yet. How is God going to do this? How is God going to provide? Because if we do have a holy God who's not our bro, we have a holy God and we are sinners who lie, cheat, steal, backstab, and are just consistently selfish all the time. I think that's true of everyone in this room. Say, we are consistently selfish. That's the essence of sin, is being bent inward on ourselves. If we are consistently selfish in this way, how are we going to be okay with God? How can a holy God be gracious? The wonder of the Lamb. The wonder of the Lamb happens here. Verse 13, there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. A substitute. Isaac lives here because another dies. Isaac lives because another dies in his place. Substitution enters the story of Scripture in this passage. And there's just over-the-top foreshadows to Christ. There's just over-the-top foreshadows. Everything about this, because we have a better view of history, is pointing us to something better here. You have the beloved son, my one and only son whom I love, carrying the wood to a death that he would endure on a mountain. And what mountain was it? Mount Moriah. Now, it is interesting that God says, Abraham, go sacrifice your son on a mountain 80 miles away. I'm sure Abraham's like, there's plenty of good mountains right around here. Why do I have to go 80 miles, 3-day journey to go sacrifice my child? Because on that same mountain is where the temple happens. And in those same hills is where Calvary happens. And on that same mountain, Jesus was asked to carry his cross up the mountain. In John 19, carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. The imagery is stark. It's just beautiful. Show us the next image here. Mount Moriah is Mount Calvary. And we look at the similarities. You're like, this is it. But it's not just the similarities, it's the contrast that we want to look at here. That he didn't just carry a stack of wood, he carried his cross. And when Isaac went to the mountain, he has his dad with him. And when Jesus goes, he says, "Where are you?" When Jesus goes, they whip him on the way. They spit on him. And when Jesus goes, there is not a substitute, because Jesus is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Jesus is the substitute. He is the provision. And in this moment, Abraham says, "God will provide." And in that moment, Jesus says, "I'm providing." And think of the agony that Jesus had with every step to the cross. Not wondering, "Can I trust God?" Every step was him saying, "I'm doing this for you." Out of sheer delight and love for you. The love of Christ is just so present in this passage. It is all about the wonder of the Lamb. And so when God seems impossible, I want you to remember, we can't see fully what God is doing at all times. When God asks the impossible, I want to remind you, it's not because he hates you, it's because he says that these non-negotiables cannot be our God. And when God does the impossible, let's marvel and wonder. Oh, the wondrous cross. Let's marvel at the love of God. And when Abraham sees this, his God's provision, in verse 14, he says, "The Lord will provide." He names the place, "The Lord will provide." He didn't name it, "The Lord will explain." And I think we all want that. We're begging, "Lord, tell me what's happening." He didn't say, "The Lord will explain." He didn't say that the Lord is going to remove all tension and all doubt. He says, "The Lord will provide." And when we do doubt, we can look to the cross and marvel at it, to trust in God and trust in his good, good character. So let me give you some so what's this week, what to walk away with this week. First, I want you to quit the why and take a step. Quit the why and take a step. Again, the Lord will provide, not the Lord will explain. I think many of us spend an enormous amount of emotional energy asking God why, and I'm right there with you. Why, Lord? Why is this happening? And many times he will not answer that. And so what may be a better use of our time, instead of spending all that time asking the why, let's just take the step. Take the next step, the way Jesus took the next step to the cross. And say, what is God asking me in this moment? I may not understand why, but what is the next faithful step? So quit the why, take the step. Second, why, so what? Open your hands and name your Isaac. I'm going to ask you this week, yes, as a pastor, I'm asking you to pray. I know that's wild. When you pray this week, will you pray with your hands open? Everyone open your hands right now. I think there's something powerful when we are physically posturing ourselves in this way and saying, "Lord, I'm open. I'm open to hear from you." And as our hands are open, we are also saying, "This is my Isaac. This is the thing I believe that if it was taken, I'd lose everything. I'm offering those non-negotiables to you, Lord." Can you do that? So open your hands, name your Isaac, and then lastly, trust his character and marvel at the cross. When Abraham looked, he saw a ram. When we as Christians look, we see Christ. And so when you are feeling the fear overwhelm you this week, look to see Christ. And you can trust his character. Like, I may not understand everything, but I know he's good because I see what he did at the cross. And so quit the why, take a step, open your hands and name your Isaac, trust his character, and marvel at the cross.